guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and at this time we start the TechNet as we've done almost every Sunday night since 1982 when the TechNet began. Main purpose of the TechNet, you guys have heard me say so often, is education. The curious radio amateurs gather at this time and teach each other what they've learned about wireless equipment, ham radio equipment in particular, and the 27 or so different kinds of ham radio. The TechNet is broken up into three sections. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. And if there's not very many sign-ins tonight, there's a couple of subjects I might discuss on anechoic chambers and also the radars that are being put on automobiles. The second section of the TechNet is where Dr. Roy, AC2GS, gives us the science talk and a mailbag. And the third section is where Paul, WS2N, gives us a space report as to what is NASA and all the other space agencies around the world and what they're doing. Let me drop. So at this time, I'm going to take check-ins. If you do have a question or a comment for the net, you're going to sign in with your call letters, your name, because I'm so forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need that sign-in because you're listening. After all these years, we believe somebody is listening. The net starts at 8 o'clock, and if there's enough enthusiasm, it lasts until midnight, 4 hours. Try to remember to leave a space in between your transmissions so that the beep occurs so that the machine doesn't time out. Okay, we're going to take check-ins at this time for people who do have a question or a comment. Just give me your call letters and your name. K2RIW, TechNet, we're listening. Is there no one to sign in tonight with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name, please.
WP2JXM, Rich, with a comment.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name. You're number one on the runway, Rich. Go right ahead with your comment. Take your time. We got lots of time tonight.
K2RW, WP2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Well, Dick, my comment is that since I don't actually have a question for you, I'm interested in your anechoic chambers and your radars on the pickle. WP2GXM.
W2YY, Joe, yes. I can't transmit my other frequency. It's not making it for some reason.
Okay, you're sounding good here, Joe. All right, so we got a real check-in of Joe. We're going to take him first before we go to those other subjects. One last call. Anyone to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the net? Give me a call letters and your name right now. Okay, Joe. You're the first person with a real question. So go right ahead. W2LYY, K2LIW.
Good evening, Nick. I combine a formula, and this has to do with testing the distortion of a RF amplifier in Class A operation, or basically, I guess, checking the distortion of the AM sidebands of an AM transmitter. And the form, and it doesn't seem to work out right. I don't understand what's going on. But it's like this: 100 times, then parentheses negative this negative sidebands, which I guess we are running 80% modulation, like minus 80 both sidebands. So 80, 100 times negative log of negative 8 divided by 20, and supposed to give you a percentage of distortion. I don't really understand it. Have you ever heard this before?
No, I haven't. And first of all, negative 8. I don't think you can take a log of a negative number. If you do, I think you get a complex answer. So If your side lobes are not 6 dB down, which was what they would be if you had 100% modulation, if they're 8 dB down, I think you're going to take the log of 8. When you divide the log of 8 by 20, you're converting that into voltage. Nope. I'm not familiar with that formula. So this is trying to predict harmonic distortion? Is that what it's trying to predict? Or percentage of modulation? What's the formula trying to predict, Joe Grant?
It's 100 times, in the paper I remember seeing, it said negative 8, but you say you can't do a log of a negative number. Log of negative number, negative log, that sideband, and it, right, it would be 80% modulation, like, minus 8 dB down on your sidebands, both approximately, divided by 20, or over 20. I'll have to inquire more about it, because I've seen it just once on some paperwork, and I want to find out more about it. It's supposed to give you an answer like 3 or 4% or something like that, but it doesn't seem to work out on a calculator at all.
I'm trying it on my calculator right now. Yeah, you get a crazy answer. So something's wrong. Where did you find that formula, Joe? Was it a respected source? And what did the source claim that the formula is going to do for you? Is it supposed to predict percentage of modulation of an AM, of a Class A amplifier?
Yeah. So it's supposed to predict or give you the answer approximately what the percentage of distortion is when the Class A amplifier is using AM at 80% modulation. This is a part of a test procedure on a system.
Yeah, what's wrong with that is that I can start off with a Class A amplifier, use a very small amount of drive, so I'm only using the center of the dynamic range of the amplifier. I could easily put 100% modulated signal through that amplifier, running very light service like that, and have essentially no harmonic distortion. So the harmonic distortion is primarily a function of how close you're coming to the full dynamic range of the Class A amplifier. If you drive it too hard and you're flat-topping and you overdrive it and you're pinching off the low end of the modulation, of course you're going to get a lot of harmonic distortion. So percentage of modulation of the resultant output signal is not the main determining factor of distortion. It's how hard you're driving that Class A amplifier. And as I said, if you're using if the Class A amplifier is capable of 100 watts of output, and you're only using it at the 1 watt level and making 100% modulation at 100 watts, you could have extremely low distortion. You see what I'm saying, Joe? B2RYY, T2RIW.
Yes, I do see what you're saying. Also, along the same lines, I was told that a Class A amplifier could stand infinite SWR, return loss. Is that true or untrue?
Of all the kinds of amplifiers that can tolerate reverse power because of standing wave ratio, Class A is probably the best because it's got a continuous bias. The last stage is always drawing some current. And I guess it's got a small ability to absorb. But there's a big difference on whether or not the Class A amplifier is solid state, bipolar, field effect, tube, and so on. And a tube amplifier can tolerate, usually, tremendous amounts of standing wave ratio with no damage. Transistorized amplifiers, it's a function of how close it is to dissipation. The reverse power to a solid state amplifier creates extra heating. And if your final stage of your transistorized amplifier is capable of 100 watts of dissipation and you're running it at the 80 watt level of dissipation, it's not going to be able to tolerate very much reflection without exceeding. Whereas there are all kinds of solid state amplifiers that can tolerate a dead short circuit or an open circuit without damage because they've got a lot of excess dissipation capability. So there's a lot more variables involved here as I see it, Joe. So B2RYY, T2RIW.
Yeah, these things were being operated somewhere around the 200 watt range in a solid state. That's what maybe asked the question about this, about the especially the formula. So I'll find out more about it. Maybe next week I'll have an opportunity to bring it up again. Back to you.
Yeah, particularly the final stage of a handy talkie, where quite often somebody might make the mistake of transmitting without the rubber duck antenna connected. So a well-designed handy talkie can tolerate a dead short, an open circuit, or whatever, and not damage the final stage. The early solid state handy talkies did suffer some damage, but the later designs, they got around that. Okay, I was reviewing some of my past paperwork, and I found out that way back in 2011, a guy named Wesley, N2XJN, asked the question in July 31, he asked the question, in the case of an RF chamber, why do the absorbers on the wall have a pyramid shape? And first of all, I'll give you a little bit of an explanation as to what an RF chamber is. If I wanted to measure the characteristics of an antenna, I'd like to measure its gain, its pattern, its standing wave ratio, or whatever. I'd like to measure it in a pure environment. Ordinarily, you set up an antenna on a test stand in your backyard, and you're transmitting from your antenna in the test, and some number of feet away, you've got a receiving antenna. And you take the antenna under test, and you, with a rotator, you rotate it in order to measure its antenna pattern. Because that's a reflective environment where you've got all kinds of stuff around giving you reflection, you're going to get a lot of erroneous results. Whereas an anechoic chamber, which is the ideal way of testing an antenna, let me drop, is usually a very large room, which has absorbers on all the walls, so any signal hitting the wall gets absorbed and nothing gets reflected. So there's nothing in the anechoic chamber except the direct signal from the antenna on the test over to the receiving antenna and the receiver. A good anechoic chamber, like the ones I've worked on at AIL, might have a dimensions of 20 feet wide, 20 feet high, 40 feet long. And all those walls and floors are filled up with this absorptive foam, black foam rubber, and it's all the foam rubber on the walls is in the form of a four-sided pyramid. So Wesley was asking the question, why in the world are is the absorber formed in pyramids? Why isn't it just a flat piece of absorber material? You go to the Andrew catalog, at least the old Andrew catalog, and you look up AN75. They make foam radio absorbing material. They make foam absorbing material like AN75 and AN79 in flat sheets. But you look at the edge of the flat sheet and you realize it's got four or five or six layers to it. And each layer has a different resistivity. The bottom line of all this is that when a radio signal hits anything but free space, I don't care if it's a chunk of wood, the leaves of a tree, whatever, it's going to see a slightly different impedance because of the dielectric constant or the resistivity or whatever of the material in space. And so you're going to get some amount of reflection. And so if you want a radio signal to be absorbed and not be reflected, you have to make a very gradual transition from the outer layer, which is a high resistivity material, and then the multiple layers of the material, and the AN79, I think, is around 4 inches thick, and it's got about six layers to it. And if you put a ohmmeter across each of those layers, at the edge, you put the probes of an ohmmeter there, you'll measure different amounts of resistivity in each of those layers. So the flat absorbing material slowly tapers from high resistivity materials on the outer surface all the way down to low resistive materials, and finally, a conductive sheet at the back. Quite often it's gold plated, but then you put it up against a metallic wall. And so at a normal angle, that material does a reasonably good job of absorbing microwave frequencies. But most anechoic chambers, very rarely do they use flat anechoic material in the walls, which, by the way, is very expensive. They use the less expensive pyramid materials. Does anybody have a guess as to why the anechoic material is formed into these spikes of pyramid-shaped chunks of foam? Give me a call letters right now if you've got a guess as to why they do that. KQIW in the TechNet.
WB2GXM.
GSM recognized. Anyone else?
WA2ZDH.
J2VDH. Anyone else?
WS2N.
WS2N, that's Paul. Anyone else? Okay. George, you're the, Rich, first, WB3GXM. Why do they do it that way?
WB2GXM. As the RF hits the pyramid, as it hits the point, it will continue traveling down into the valleys, if you will, until it gets to a point where there is no place else for it to go. And there's very little surface area in the valleys for it to get reflected back. So I imagine the shape helps with absorption.
You're absolutely right. The shape does help with the distortion. And you've got a partially good answer. Let's see what John's got to say about all this. The B2VDH, T2RAW. Go ahead, John.
Well, yeah, I would think it's also that it's a gradual transition from the free space condition to the absorptive material. So the more gradual the transition, the less chance of reflection. And also, I guess the pyramidal shape tends to reflect it onto other material if there is any reflection, giving it still better absorption. Okay?
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer also, John. And we'll discuss that a little bit further. Paul, WS2N, let's see what he's got to say. You got it, Paul.
I think the shape is, you know, it's opposite to quantum reflection. Quantum reflection, no matter what way you point at it, it comes directly back at you. So you don't want it to come back. So I think it's, you know, similar to the idea of the stealth fighters. You know, they design them with all these angular, you know, triangular type of pieces wherever they could, so the signal won't come back to them, to transmit.
Very fine, Paul. Paul, your signal's a little bit noisy tonight. About 10% noise, 90% audio. So, wonder if your antenna is aimed correctly, and if you're putting out the usual amount of power. Later on, you might want to do something to make the noise a little bit less during the space report. Okay, all of you guys have got pretty much the right idea. Assuming that the anechoic material is on the back wall of the chamber, in other words, you're at the forward wall, you've got the antenna in the chest near the forward wall. Where the receiving antenna is near the back wall, you've got 40 feet away, very close to a planar signal hitting that wall with a whole bunch of pyramids on it. Picture the wave front, a completely flat wave front, hitting a wall full of pyramids. At very first, the tips of the pyramids are piercing that flat sheet. So that it's a kind of a taper. It's a geometric taper of impedance of that wave. So as the wave penetrates further down into the cracks, the pyramid is penetrating more and more of that flat wave front, and therefore the wave front thinks it's seeing a gradual transition of impedance being done geometrically, as opposed to the AN75 or AN79 material, where it's done with individual sheets of different resistivity. It's a lot easier, a lot cheaper to make the pyramid shape. And if the walls do give you a reflection, the walls are at a crazy angle, so the signal reflecting off the walls of the pyramid go off into some crazy angles. The signal could zigzag itself down between two adjacent pyramids, and on each bounce it gets absorbed. So, in general, the pyramids give you much better absorption. Let me drop. But there's a catch. The height of the pyramids is a function of the wavelength. As you go to lower and lower frequencies, the pyramids have to be taller and taller. So if you want a chamber to work all the way down to 1 gigahertz, for instance, those pyramids might be almost a foot high. And a pyramid of foam a foot high against a flat vertical wall eventually starts sagging. And so you have to update the chamber from time to time because the pyramids wear out, so to speak, and start sagging. To make an anechoic chamber very low in reflectivity, below 1 gigahertz is very difficult. At 10 gigahertz and 20 gigahertz is easy, but below down close to 1 gigahertz and below to make a low reflectivity chamber. A really good chamber, all the reflections off the walls and ceiling, you'd like them to be 40 dB down, 1/10,000th the power that hits. And so, as long as the signal is hitting the pyramids at a normal angle, in other words, you've got a flat wall full of pyramid-shaped absorbers. The foam of the absorber has carbon granules measured into it, embedded into it. So it's a resistive foam volumetric material of a particular shape. It does a pretty good job of absorbing. It turns all the RF energy that gets absorbed in there into heat. Let me drop. And that can represent a problem because one of the tests that was done at AIL once was at a very high power jamming pod that's hung below the pylon of the wing of an EA-6B aircraft where it puts out kilowatts of power. Somebody decided to test one of those by putting it above some walk-on RAM, radar absorbing material. In other words, these pyramids were buried into material that has other stuff on top of it so you can walk on it. So the person put the jamming pod above the walk-on RAM and turned on the transmitter. Well, the power was being absorbed inside the walk-on RAM, getting hotter and hotter, had no way of cooling it, eventually burst into flame, and the bottom line is a multi-million dollar chamber got burned down. That occurred way back in, I think it was around 1990 at AIL. The chamber got burned down because somebody didn't realize that all that RF power coming out is being turned into heat, and the heat's got to go somewhere. So, you guys have got some idea now as to why the chamber works with pyramid-shaped anechoic material. And it works very well when the material is at a normal angle to the wall the material is mounted on. Let me drop. But now there's a catch. One of the biggest chambers I've ever worked on is the one at the Benningfield Anechoic Facility out at Edwards Air Force Base in California. That chamber was something like 330 feet squared and 70 feet high, acre and a half of floor space. And the full-size B-1B bomber was put in there, and it was only suspended 15 feet above the floor on the 70-foot high chamber. And the wing glove transmitters were turned on, so it's transmitting signals from 50 feet above the floor out into this 300-foot square space. And therefore, the pyramids on the floor, the signal was hitting the sides of the pyramids. The signal was coming in at a grazing angle, and the sides of the pyramid were giving high reflectivity. And so the signal reflected back to the airplane and was creating some real good grief. And I remember trying to talk the engineers of that chamber in order to increase its performance, to stop the echoes that were getting off the floor, to tilt all those chunks. The pyramid material, some of it is made in 2 foot squares, or 2 or 3 foot squares, where you've got four pyramids on each square. I was asking them to put cardboard wedges underneath so that each of the pyramid squares were aimed toward the airplane, and they thought that was too much work. So the bottom line is we made the chamber more anechoic by taking the anechoic material off the floor, leaving bare concrete. The signal reflected off the smooth floor at a grazing angle, then went into the wall a couple hundred feet away and got absorbed. So the chamber became more anechoic by removing the anechoic material off the floor. Quite an experience. When I was advising them to do that, they thought I was crazy, and I said, try it, you'll like it, and they did. If any further questions or comments on anechoic radar absorbing material, K2RIW on TechNet.
BDH with a question.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was wondering, what's the optimal shape of those pyramids? Would the optimal shape be an exponential taper rather than a linear triangular taper? Go ahead.
When you say exponential taper, does that mean the tip of the pyramid would be more sharp and it would be more blunt down the bottom? Is that the way you're picturing it, John? Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, something following, like E to the minus X, where it's very pointy at the tip, and then rather than going as a straight line like a triangle, following an exponential function, where the base would be very wide. Right?
I think you're right, John. I think that would be slightly better. But there's a catch. You've now got this tall exponential spike being poorly supported, so now the survivability of the anechoic material when mounted to a vertical wall is another factor. It'd be more difficult. They make the foam by starting off with a flat sheet of, a thick sheet of this absorptive foam. In other words, they start off with the foam with carbon granules buried in it, and you make a thick sheet of the foam, and then by having a hot wire drawn through it, they cut it, they cut the foam into these pyramid shapes. And you could do it that way. The increase in performance would be not huge, but the survivability, the cost would be higher, the survivability would be low. As long as you make the pyramid tall enough, big enough, for the wavelength you're operating at, at a normal angle, the radio signal hitting the pyramid will give you a 40 dB absorption. That's good enough. The exponential table may make the 40 go to 50, but it's a lot of extra work and a lot of vulnerability to get that extra performance. So I think you're right, but that hasn't become a popular way of doing it, John. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, fine business. Yeah, I could see structurally it would be a problem. The reason I ask is that I've seen some WI-90 waveguide dummy loads where they have a wafer of carbon granule card inside there, and it did have that exponential shape to it. But that, as you said, that was for a very low power termination.
When you're putting a resorptive material in the end of a piece of waveguide in order to make a dummy load, as long as you make the material narrow enough, what's the word I'm looking for? As long as the material, if you made a dummy load that was only 6 inches peak to from the sharp point down to the base, you'd get a certain amount of performance. Make it 12 inches, 18 inches long. You make the absorber longer and longer, so that the angle along the side of the absorber becomes a sharper angle, and the absorber is a longer length. As you do that, and you make it more into a pencil, so to speak, you get better and better absorption. So you don't need an exponential taper, as long as you're willing to make the absorber long enough. So that signal will eventually get completely absorbed. I was, for instance, making dummy loads in circular waveguide at X-band, 3/4 inch water pipe. Make a very good waveguide, round waveguide at the 10 gigahertz ham band. And you can take a wooden dowel that's 3/4 inch in outside diameter and taper the wooden dowel and make the taper long enough, like 8 or 10 inches. Just the water absorption that's in the wood makes it a good dummy load. And I was able to make a pencil-shaped dowel shoved into the end of a piece of waveguide and managed to make it 30-35 dB of reflection coefficient at X-band with no fancy techniques at all, other than an ordinary wooden dowel fresh off the floor of the Home Depot store with a little bit of water absorption was in it, acting as a dummy load. Just the wood itself was doing it. Didn't have to make it the carbon granule coated or whatever. So dummy loads, there's a lot of materials that people have used for dummy loads. So, like cutting up a bicycle tire, the black rubber of a bicycle tire, cut it into the right shape and put it into a piece of waveguide, you can make a good dummy load out of that. Over to you for any comments on all of the above, John. WA2VDH, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, fine business there. Now that you mentioned it, I did have one little question about circular waveguides. Could I ask that now?
That was an excellent time. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, on I know you have mentioned this before. Using the 3/4 inch copper tubing for waveguide, the mode it operates in it, doesn't that mode tend to... If you're coming from a coaxial cable to waveguide coupling, doesn't that mode tend to decouple under load? In other words, doesn't the distribution of the fields in the waveguide tend to rotate and therefore not coupled to the coax waveguide apparatus when you're trying to couple out of the waveguide, because there's nothing holding the fields in a certain orientation as it is in rectangular waveguide. Go ahead.
Yeah, at X-band, the popular piece of waveguide is WR90. WR stands for waveguide rectangular, and 90 means it's a 9/10 of an inch wide inside dimension, and something like 0.45 inches of vertical dimension. Rectangular waveguide, the TE10 mode, is where if you have the wide surface of the waveguide flat on the table, that would give you a signal going down the waveguide that is vertically polarized. The signal would be strongest in the center of the waveguide, and it goes to zero at the left-hand and right-hand edge, to 0.45 inch edge. And so in the center of the 9/10 of an inch edge is where the signal is strongest. And if you plotted signal strength versus position, it's a half sine wave shape. And so rectangular waveguide, there's only one way the signal can go down there as long as you're in the right frequency region, 8 to 12 gigahertz. It can't twist. In the case of circular waveguides made out of 3/4 inch copper water pipe, straight out of a Home Depot, let me drop it. Even though the stuff is a hell of a lot cheaper than rectangular waveguides, you get a lot lower loss. That's the good news. But if the waveguide has any run out, any lack of perpulence, perfect being circular, if the waveguide is a little bit flattened, then the signal going down the waveguide can rotate in polarization, and that can give you some trouble. You can get around that problem by periodically putting in a vertical piece of sheet metal, an iris they call it, which forces, that would be forcing horizontal polarization, a vertical piece of metal, a thin sheet of metal down the guide. The launcher for a circular waveguide means that you've got a connector mounted in the side of the circular pipe, maybe an SMA connector, roughly 1/4 inch from the short-circuited end, and there's a probe inside going to the center conductor of that connector. That acts like a monopole, and it launches a signal. If the connector is on top or the bottom of the waveguide, it would launch a vertically polarized signal. And as long as you think your waveguide was perfectly round, the signal would stay vertically polarized all the way down. And you can use 45-degree bends, 90-degree bends, and whatever with circular waveguide. With impedance-correcting devices, you can make some very interesting microwave structures out of 3/4-inch water pipe, and the adapters that go on it that change from one size pipe to another can act as a feed horn. The inexpensive materials out of Home Depot plumbing department can give you beautiful waveguide components. And there's ways that you can test whether or not the signal has been rotated going down your guide, and there's ways of correcting it. You can put screws penetrating the waveguide a small amount in certain directions to correct the polarization. And you can also do that as an impedance matching device, and filters, and so on. So you'd be amazed. Simple things like screws in that circular waveguide can act as a filter, a polarization rotator. You can take a piece of round circular waveguide and putting screws into it at a 45-degree angle on two different surfaces, top and bottom surfaces. You can force the signal going down there, starting off as a linear vertical polarized signal. You can force the signal to come out of the waveguide as circular polarization if you're a little bit smart in the way you do things. And it's not expensive. Understanding the theory of how it works is something else, but you'd be amazed how if you look at, let me drop it. If you look at the dual mode feed horn by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, which is in the ARRL book on antennas, you'll see that by putting screws in there, I think he's got a total of 6 sets of screws, I believe, on the upper, on two surfaces, on, you know, 6 sets of screws at the 130 portion and the 730 portion of a round piece of waveguide. By putting 6 screws with the right spacing between them and the screws penetrating the right amount, you can take a linear polarized signal and create it into a circular polarization on that dual mode horn, which is the design, as I said, is in the one of the earlier issues of the antenna book. It's one of the back chapters of the antenna manual from ARRL. You probably got some questions on all of the above, John. W2EDH, K2LAW.
Yeah, fine, this is Dick. Yeah, or could it also be done if you, when you come out of the circular bag, go to a circular to rectangular converter with a, you know, a gradual taper into the rectangular shape, which would get you back to the TE10 mode in the rectangular, right?
You're exactly right. I built one of those structures. If you take a round piece of 3/4 inch water pipe and hammer it on it just right, you can slowly taper it, and maybe with some cutting and soldering, you can slowly taper it from a circular waveguide to a rectangular waveguide. And if you slowly taper between the 3/4 inch round to WR90, you can end up with a perfect launching of signal, extremely low reflection of signal, in other words, very low standing wave ratio, impedance matcher. In circular waveguide, because they use different definitions for the axes, the circular waveguide signal, the dominant signal, they call it the TE11 mode. But it happens to be the identical mode as the TE10 mode in rectangular guide. Just like slowly taper from one to the other, and the signal doesn't even know it has happened. So yes, you can definitely do that kind of launching. And when a bunch of us were doing a 10 gigahertz experiment about 10 years ago, we were building structures like this to act as horns and whatever in front of our 3 foot and 5 foot and 6 foot diameter parabolic dish antennas that we were using on the 10 gigahertz handband. And we were running sun noise measurements. We would aim the dish at the sun, put a low noise preamplifier at the feed horn at the center of the dish, and measure smooth. By measuring the amount of noise you get off the sun with the right kind of calibration, you could easily find out what is the noise figure of your receiving system. Back to you, John. To B2VDH, KQLIW.
Okay, very fine, Dick. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah, that's some interesting thing. I have some hopes of when I retire getting into microwave amateur radio. It's just a dream of mine, I guess, but we'll see how it goes. Anyway, thanks for the information. Really appreciate it.
Not as difficult as you think. You can buy from various sources a transverter. The usual transverter has got a 10.224, I think it is, gigahertz signal. You use 144 megs as the IF. So you take a 10 milliwatt or a fraction of a watt signal at 144 megahertz, put it into the transverter. That mixes it up to the main calling frequency is 10.368. 10,368 megahertz is the frequency. And how do they choose that frequency? It's I think it's a 72nd harmonic of 144. So using 144 megs as a reference signal with a good frequency reference, so you know that you're on 144.0, and listen to the 72nd harmonic, you know you're on 10.368. You can find yourself. And so to get on the 10 gigahertz band saying that hello CQ 10.368, this is K2RIW listening, carefully tuning the band. Well, you're only going to carefully tune plus or minus 100 kc or so. The 10 gigahertz handband starts at 10.0 to 10.5. The 10 gigahertz handband is 500 megahertz wide, 10.0 to 10.5. And we have primary use of that. Not very much interferes with us. Occasionally there's a radar in there, but not very many of them. And so, and you can reflect signals off of rain clouds and mountains and buildings. We used to reflect signals off the World Trade Center. There was a guy down in New Jersey who would aim his antenna from the eastern shore of New Jersey, dead north to the World Trade Center. I, out here on Long Island, would aim my signal, my 2 foot dish on top of the tower, dead west at the World Trade Center. And by bouncing 10 gigahertz signals off the World Trade Center, we were talking to each other. And there were times when a thunderstorm would come along, you'd bounce the signal off the rain clouds and so on. So it behaves rather differently. But my best DX on 10 gigs was a guy down in the eastern shore of Virginia. I think it was 380 miles away. I was running a couple of watts. No, I was only running a 200 milliwatts. And we're talking single sideband to each other with a band opening. When you live within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean, 10 gigahertz band will give you a band opening, some portion of every 24-hour day. Let me drop. When you get a layer of moist air down low and drier air up higher, that 10 gigahertz signal senses that the higher dielectric constant of the moist air and goes to a downward bending as it propagates. And if the downward bending follows Earth's curvature, the guy 380 miles away running a small number of watts into his dish sounds like he's in your backyard. So the band has got some crazy characteristics, as you can tell. And some of them are a lot of fun. So you put a 144 meg signal into this transverter. That moves the signal up to 10.368. And then by amplifiers at 10.368, gas fed amplifiers, you can easily build that up to a 10-watt signal that you actually transmit from your dish. A 2-foot dish on 10 gigs gives something like a 36 dB of gain, as I remember, and about a 3 or 4 degree beam width. You've got to be a little bit careful in aiming it. So establishing the right kind of test equipment and know what you're doing is a little bit shaky at first. But you read the articles and people have done it. I think you'll enjoy it if you do decide to do that as a hobby. And you don't have to wait until you retire. You could start doing it right now, John. It's A2VDH, K2RIW. And after John gives his talk, I'll stand by for other people with other questions on this subject. You first, John, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah, I've seen some of the material there, the catalogs, yeah, Down East Microwave on their website, and it got me intrigued. Main thing, though, is time that I have to devote to it. That's why I speak of retirement. Okay, Dick, I really appreciate it. Thanks for the information. I'll turn it back to you for other comments.
Anybody have any questions on this subject before we go to the next subject? Give me your call letters right now.
WS2N.
WS2N, go right ahead, Paul.
Where did you get this transverter to go up to 10 gig? Did you build it, or was it commercially available?
I bought mine. I can't remember now the call letters of the guy in Germany that was building these things. I'll eventually think of his call letters and name. But I'm trying to remember now, what was the price of the thing? A few hundred dollars, as I remember. The transverter had a local oscillator chain. Started off with something like 100 meg, a 7/5 overtone crystal. And 10.224 mixed with 144 makes 10.368, as I remember. So it's got a local oscillator, mixer, amplifier stages, filters, and so on. So the transverter is a box, which, as I remember, was about 10 inches long, 5 inches wide, 2 inches high. You put 144 megs into it when you're transmitting, and when you're receiving, you get 144 megs back out of it. Waveguide going up the tower is pretty lossy no matter how you do it. So I mounted the transverter in a box that was mounted behind the dish, and so I only had to send 144 megs signal up a coax cable up the tower in order to transmit and receive, if you know what I mean. So my system with pre-amplification and whatever had a pretty good noise figure and very little 10 gig signal, because the total length of 10 gigahertz transmission line from the box behind the dish to the horn was, you know, a 1 or 2 feet of waveguide. So I had very little loss. And the only real loss was the 144 megs of the cable going up to the transverter. And because of enough gain coming back down and enough signal going back up, the loss didn't count as far as the signal performance is concerned, the loss of the 144 meg signal. So that's one of the easiest ways of doing it. Just buy the transverter. You can build it, and there's schematics and articles about how to build it, but quite a bit of work. And so now you have to make a decision as to you take a couple of hours of your labor at your job and then just write a check and buy the thing? Or do you spend a few weeks of your time building it? It's your choice. WS2N, K2IW, great Paul.
Very good. Now, how did you power it? It's all the way up near your antenna. You have to run a separate line up just to power it, get a DC source into it?
Yes, I did. It ran on 12 volts, so I had a 12 volt cable going up to it, which I think was a piece of coax cable, by the way. A piece of hard line. Semiconductor with plus 12 on it and a shield with the ground. That's one way of getting a low loss piece of 12 volt signal. And I think I put 13 volts into the cable down at the bottom of the tower in order to make sure it had 12 volts on the load at the top, something like that. And another wire going up there in order to give the command to the transverter to go from the transmit mode to the receive mode. So that worked pretty well until a heavy wind came along and damaged the dish, and I haven't had a chance to put that back up. I'm going to do that one of these days, put that 10 gig signal back up on the top of my tower. So feeding 12 volts up to it, or you could, if you want to, feed 110 volts with various safety mechanisms up there and a 12 volt power supply up there in the box. That's another way of doing it. People have done it various ways along that. An awful lot of the 10 gig signals used to be guys going to mountaintops and beachfronts with a dish on a tripod and doing it as a rover. A small number of high-class guys would set up their 10 gig system on the top of their tower at home. Home installations are a lot more fun because when the band opens from home, you can easily operate. When the band opens and you're not on the top of the mountain, you don't get a chance to take full advantage of it, if you know what I mean. WS2N, K2RIW, Red Bull.
Okay, yeah, that sounds very interesting. Yeah, I like the base setup. You know, you see it in QST all the time, with the guy on the top of the mountain with the dish. You know he's got everything right there next to him. But, yeah, okay, I see how you did it. Very well done. Back to you there.
Every year in August and September is the 10 gigahertz contest. That's what I call it. I'm not quite sure what it's called. One weekend in August and one weekend in September, 10 gigs and above contest. And an awful lot of those guys operate portable. What they do is they go to various mountaintops and beachfronts, and they set up 144 meg equipment, 100 watts into a good 2-meter Yagi as the liaison. In other words, you get on 144.260 single sideband and say, hey, I'm calling CQ for the 10 gig contest. Somebody get back to me on 2 meters and say, hey, I'm located at grid number so-and-so, or latitude and longitude so-and-so. So you calculate which way to aim the dish in that direction. And you set up the signal by way of a feedback. In other words, the guy sends you a 10 gig signal. The calling station aims his 10 gig signal at you. You receive it on top of the mountain on 10 gigs, and whatever you hear, you play it back on 144 megs so that he can hear it. And so as he's aiming his dish back and forth, and he's listening to that tone coming back of a key down signal in the Morse code mode, he knows when his signal is aimed correctly. And so by using the 144 meg talkback, as they call it, in both directions, you end up aiming the dishes peaked at each other. And now, once you know the dishes are peaked at each other, you stop using 144 megs and then make the QSO on 10 gigs and send the information back and forth as call letters, signal strength, and whatever. And that becomes an official 10 gig signal. But the main calling frequency is on 144 megs. The reason for that is the dish itself is quite often a good high-gain dish on 10 gigs. It's got a 3-degree beamwidth. And if you're sitting on top of the mountain, how do you know which direction to aim the darn thing with a 3-degree beamwidth in order to find the people out there during the contest? So 144 megs becomes very handy. WS2N, K2IW. Does all that make sense, Paul?
Yes, it does. Very, very interesting. I'm searching the internet for transverters as we speak. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
And so any further questions as to how to get on 10 gigs? An exciting band. You're a real microwave when you're up there. And when you've got that dish, like what I would sometimes do is set up a dish in my ham room, a 3-foot dish, as long as the signal I'm talking to, the guy is 10 miles away from the top of his tower, I can hear the signal coming into my dish that's in the room with me. And by waving my hand in front of the dish while I'm receiving his signal, the signal bouncing off my hand gives a Doppler shift, and you hear a rumbling sound as you wave your hand in front of the dish. And you can do that on top of a mountain, too. So you can easily hear Doppler shift. And there are people who have set up a horn on top of a horn, on top of an automobile, on 10 gigs while they're transmitting and receiving. And you hear all kinds of fancy tones due to the Doppler shift of the automobile moving. I think a signal on 10 gigs at 30 miles an hour gives you a 400 hertz tone or a 1 kc tone. I'm not quite sure what the frequency is, but you can easily calculate that. So there are guys who have done mobile QSOs on 10 gigs with a horn on top of a car, sometimes with a Armstrong rotating system, in other words, a pipe going through the roof of the car to the horn, and from the driver's seat, you rotate the pipe in order to aim it at the guy as you drive along. There are guys who have done that. Or put the pipe out the window of the car, going down from the window into the armrest of the car. Is a more convenient way. I don't like drilling holes in the roof of my car, if you know what I mean. Anyone have any further comments on any of the above? Give me a call those right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Now, one of the subjects that I was speculating on, and when you look it up, you'll find out that frequencies have been set aside for automobile radar, for collision avoidance radar, on frequencies like 74 and 79 to 82 gigahertz. And I was speculating, and pretty sure I found out that yes, most of these radars are solid state, mounted behind the plastic grill in the front of a car, and they are CW swept radar. The way an FM swept radar works is that the signal being transmitted is continuous. The radar might be sweeping from, let's say, 78 to 81 gigahertz. In that example I'm giving, I'm sweeping a 3 gigahertz region, 78 to 81, with a sawtooth waveform, and maybe sweeping 600 times per second or something like that. And so by way of directional couplers on the transmitter, so that the receiver is not being overloaded by the transmitter signal, but the directional coupler is set up to favor the echo signal coming back. You're transmitting a signal to, let's say, an automobile that's in front of you. The echo comes back, and because of the sawtooth sweeping and the time delay, the signal coming back is slightly shifted in frequency. Depending on how far you're sweeping in megahertz and how fast you're sweeping, the signal is the difference in frequency coming back is equivalent to range. Maybe a 300 hertz offset is a 100-foot range, so to speak. So the radar has got an IF strip that's only a fraction of a megahertz wide, looking for that reflected signal that's going to track the transmitting signal on the sawtooth going up and coming back down. Because an adjacent automobile with a similar radar is doing its own sweeping across 3 gigs, and it's only when the signals are within a fraction of a megahertz to each other are you going to be creating any interference. So the probability of interference of two radars, two automobiles side by side, interfering with each other is extremely low. And one will sweep through the other's IF strip, just for a fraction of a microsecond, so to speak, and so not much really happens. So you can make a radar that way rather inexpensively, but pretty high in performance. So that's somewhat how the radars on automobiles with collision avoidance work, and will put on automatic braking when they see something in front of them at too close a range or too close a closing rate. By looking at the signal coming back, let me drop this. The difference in frequency represents range. The rate at which the frequency changes represents range rate. In other words, are you approaching or are you retarding? So by properly analyzing that echo signal in the IF strip of the radar, you can easily detect the range and range rate of the object that's in front of you and decide whether or not it's time to put on the brakes to make sure you don't hit it. And for any further questions on automobile radar, give me your call letters now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
I know that that's going to be the wave of the future. I'll have to get used to it. My car doesn't have it. I have a Honda 2011, so I don't have anything like that, but it's something to look forward to. What we do have, though, is that when you walk around the store, the supermarket out here, they have these robots. They wander around the store, and it's some kind of spinning thing. It looks like a light coming out of the bottom of it, and I think that's what's looking at where it's going, so it doesn't walk into people or anything else. It might be a LIDAR. It reminds me of something that you would see that the cars have for LIDARs. Like instead of something spinning at the top, this thing's near the bottom. But I think this might be a similar type of thing that what the cars are doing.
Now, the robot that's walking around the store, why is it there and what is it doing, Paul?
Stop and Shop has them now. There's a couple of Stop and Shops that have this thing now. It has its own charging location, so when battery's low, it goes back there. And it wanders around the store, it rolls around the store. It's looking for things that might be in the aisle, a can that falls off the shelf, it'll spot that and automatically notify the counter that, there's something in aisle 10, that has to be gotten. It doesn't have any arms or anything, it can't do it, but it notifies them. KHUGZ.
GV, recognize 10 by a minute now. Paul, your signal is very abruptly stopped, so are you still there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yes. Well, let me turn this thing. I'll try again. Trying again. I'm going into Selden. Maybe that's not working.
It's working like a charm, so go right ahead, Paul.
I'm trying to think if I should turn this even more. I don't know. Okay, very good. To give you an idea, this robot is, like I said, by Stop and Shop, and it looks around the aisles and looks to see if a can or something is on the floor, and then it just notifies the counter. It doesn't have any arms. It can't pick it up and put it back on the shelf, but, that's from what I understand the purpose of this thing. But it wanders around. It goes from aisle to aisle. It's really strange. Quite tall, so it's bigger than me. Back to you.
I presume that thing rolls very slowly so that a person can easily get out of its way. And if it hits you, it would be hitting you very slowly. Is that true, Paul?
Oh, I tested that out. I walked right up to it, and then it just stopped. it's got these two big eyes, make-believe eyes, that'll just stare at you, But when it's communicating, the lights blink near the top. I don't know, it's really weird. But yeah, they have them in at least two Stop and Shops that I know of. I guess they will all eventually have them.
Interesting. Okay, I think somebody else checked in, GV or something like that. Give me a call letter, the name. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW.
Kilo Alpha 2, Uniform Golf Zulu. Good evening, Dick.
Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, the robots are actually checking stock in the aisles. They're looking for stock outs. They're checking planograms. They're checking the barcodes to make sure that the stock that's on the shelf matches what's on the barcode. And generate work orders for people to come and stock the shelf, or to make sure that the label matches, or the sale item label has been taken down. So they're doing all those things that used to be done by people, and then they're, just as the other station was saying, they generate work tickets to go and have people come back and make corrections. KA2UGZ.
Very fine, Jay. Jay, while you're here, quick.